One of my midlife realizations is that people in my world, certainly me, ascribe too much to ideology and too little to money. The financial dynamics of the world drive a lot more than we acknowledge that they do. And we look at things, we're like, oh, these people believe this and these people believe that, and that's why they're fighting, or that's why they're allies or whatever. But really, we should all remember that the love of money is the root of all evil, and money really has a huge effect on outcomes, but nobody says that. And I miss it so often. So you spent your life in the money business, trading debt. Tell us just to start, but like, you worked in Ukraine, you traded Ukrainian debt. What was that like?
I never worked in Ukraine. I've been to Ukraine on investor trip. I have traded Ukraine debt. I traded emerging markets debt my whole life until May of this year. I traded and sold it at a bunch of different banks, London and New York. Ukraine was certainly one of the instruments we traded through the Russia crisis.
Can you explain, just for the truly ignorant me among them, what is emerging markets debt?
So emerging markets debt, originally, the asset class grew out of the debt crisis of the 1980s, when money center banks were hung with primarily Latin America debt. After the 80s crisis, Nicholas Brady, Treasury Secretary at the time, came up with a plan called the Brady Plan to restructure the debt, back it with collateral U.S. Treasury strips that would make it more palatable to a broader base of investors, to get it off the balance sheets of the money center banks and to create a more of an institutional uptake of the debt and retail uptake of the debt.
So American debt, American banks are left with loans from other countries that those countries can't repay.
Correct.
I'm just trying to put it in terms like I can understand. So then the Treasury Secretary basically says to those banks, we'll bail you out by guaranteeing these loans with American treasuries?
It's one way to put it. It's a way to clean the balance sheet up and to create, I think there are two impacts. One, you clean up the bank's balance sheets, get it off their sheet, and create a marketplace and a dynamic that allows liquidity for this debt, and then creates a whole new marketplace and ability to issue and clean up the country's balance. So you're doing good for the banks and you're doing good for the countries, and theoretically doing good for a whole new investor base. And that started in the early 90s, and I kind of walked into Wall Street in the early 90s out of college, and I just fell into this market that was starting and really boomed for a while.
And so what does that mean to attach a treasury to foreign debt? Can you tell us layman's terms what that means? To treasury strips, what is that?
Treasury strips is zero coupon bonds, effectively. So you have collateral, you have risk-free collateral that's attached to the bonds, so that to get investors who would obviously wary of sub-investment grade emerging market, at that time it was called less developed countries, LDC, then it evolved into emerging markets debt, which actually is sort of a misnomer at this point, because it characterizes almost everything outside of G7, from
right.
Single A debt to defaulted debt. So it's grown over the last 30 years to incorporate sovereign debt of countries, primarily issued in hard currency, dollars and euros, down to investment grade corporates, government owned debt, like oil companies, let's say nationalized oil companies that would be called quasi-sovereigns, down to corporate debt, all the way down to defaulted debt. So it's all of credit, all credit products in a number of countries. It's ballooned. But at the infancy, it was really a evolving asset class to kind of clean up the balance sheets and open access back to lending to these countries. And instead of just being reliant on major money center banks for loans that really sat on their balance sheet and weren't that liquid, didn't trade much, let's open it up to a global investor base, trade euro bonds.
Understanding the complexity of debt crises is crucial, as they often intertwine with currency instability and market responses. This foundation sets the stage for the discussion on Ukraine, where geopolitical factors complicate recovery efforts. What implications will this have for fiscal strategies moving forward?
Ukraine's is a different one than, say, in Argentina, because it has at the moment more of a geopolitical put, so to speak, than pick a random country like Bolivia or Argentina. Although now under this administration, clearly there's more with sort of Monroe Doctrine part two, there's more of a geopolitical put to Argentina. But Ukraine's a tricky one because there are, you obviously up until recently, you had the entire West behind them, right? And there's this week alone, you've got Larry Fink, Witkoff, and Kushner over there working on, you know, stage two of what's going to happen, the peace process, but also the rebuild. So it's an odd one. I think that's going to be a combination of public and private, because there'll be so much rebuild to do, and there'll be a lot of money to be made in the rebuild.
What does a debt crisis look like? What is a debt crisis?
Well, a debt crisis typically is not a debt crisis alone. It's accompanied by a currency crisis, the debt crisis, the external debt, and then a local market interest rate crisis, which is also debt in itself. So the local T-bills, local interest rates will skyrocket at first to try to raise interest rates to try to attract money to the currency to stem the rout on the currency. And that can work up until a point until you lose control of both. So what a debt crisis looks like is runaway currency devaluation, runaway higher interest rates, which clamps down any lending locally, clamps down any local growth, creates defaults on domestic businesses, the currency running away depending on the country, but all countries, it causes inflation, but countries that rely on imports certainly even more, right? Everything you're bringing in is going to cost far more in your local currency. So it's really a spiral. And then typically what happens is bonds will drop to a level that's called recovery value. And recovery value is effectively what is a term more from the corporate credit markets, where if you were to strip everything down and sell it for parts, what could you get? What could you get for the cash value?
So interest rates spike, bond values drop.
Collapse, yes.
What does this have to do with debt? Why is it described as a debt crisis?
Because no one can function without borrowing. No one can function without debt. So if you can't borrow, you can't exist.
And there's no country that's not true of?
There are countries that don't necessarily need to borrow as much as they do, but they still do.
Why?
Because they can cheaply. I would argue the GCC countries don't necessarily need to borrow as much as they have.
The Gulf, yeah. Persian Gulf countries.
But they have recently, Saudi, for example, because they're going on a massive expansion to diversify themselves away from their core business, which is oil, which is actually a very wise thing to do, because if you look at countries historically, Venezuela is probably the most extreme example there was a single A rated country in the 80s. I went there in the 90s, I mean, gleaming infrastructure, like incredible highways, beautiful hotels, amazing place. And they never took the oil wealth and diversified away from it in a meaningful way. And then when you have an oil shock and you've taken out too much debt against the, let's make up a number, $100 oil price, and oil drops to 30, you're all upside down. And so that's what, that's what MBS is looking at for a multi-decade plan to build, build these cities, technology, innovation centers, and so forth, which is clearly learning from the past, but
they're borrowing to do that.
As we delve deeper into the implications of national borrowing, it's crucial to recognize how countries are securing funds at low rates, shaping global economies. This backdrop enriches our understanding of the dynamics at play, especially as we explore the transition from sovereign debt to military dominance and its profound effects on currency status.
There's also a concept that you want to borrow as the sovereign level to set a benchmark against which your companies can borrow in international markets. This would be the broader the investor base, theoretically, the cheaper the interest rate. So they'll set a benchmark level, and then a corporation can borrow at that rate plus 20 basis points or 50 basis points.
Well, some Americans have become cut off from the things that once kept us grounded, our land, the skills that tied our families to nature.
Here's the next spot. Woo!
And to remind us, we made a new 6-part series, American Game, Tales from the Wild. We follow the sportsmen who are keeping these ancient traditions alive. We follow a former Navy SEAL into the mountains of Texas, Donald Trump Jr. across the ridges of Lanai.
That's what we call from going from zero to hero.
And wander with me through the quiet woods of Maine.
I have just 3 dog commands, and then as I direct the dogs, find the bird, and then dead bird, obviously, which I don't use as much as I'd like to.
We cast for steelhead on the Deschutes River in Oregon.
That's the first one I've caught in a while.
Track mule deer in the Utah high country, spearfish in the waters off Montauk, chasing striped bass and bluefin tuna.
See you on the other side.
It's called American Game, Tales from the Wild, an outdoor series. Watch it at tuckercarlson.com.
So if every country's indebted, I mean, debt decreases your sovereignty, your ability to make independent decisions.
That's correct.
Yeah. So if every country's in debt, then there are no fully sovereign countries then, right? Can't just, it's not, no country is free to do exactly what it thinks it should do in its own interest. They're all connected.
No. And again, back to the U.S., I mean, theoretically, we are or were based on the fact that we have a global reserve currency, but there is a limit to everything at some point.
So what's the limit for the United States?
It's hard to say what the limit is. The limit is what loses the global reserve currency status, right? And as I alluded to before, these things don't happen quickly. They happen over a much longer period of time than anyone would think. So how do you, in simple terms to me, let's look at some global reserve currencies. Historically, Dutch guilder, British pound, US dollar, probably the most obvious examples in relatively recent history. And what did they all have in common? They ruled the seas, military dominance, right? And, you'll see memes online where people say, pictures of fleets of aircraft carriers in the Gulf and displays of military power, and that's what backs my currency. And that is true. But, at some point, you got to ask yourself a question like how did empires from Rome to the Dutch, to the Brits, like imperial overreach to an extent was what undid them, right?
And yes.
If we continue to, what concerns me longer term of the potential to lose the reserve status is if we lose our military dominance. That's not happening, obviously, tomorrow, the next day. There's a few things that could, obviously. I mean, you're more versed than I am in this whole notion of modern day drone warfare, but that certainly levels the playing field very, very quickly. You see what the Houthis were able to do with not so sophisticated and not very expensive drone technology.
No.
But that's the purview for some military expert, not me. The other thing that concerns
me, but the structure remains the same. So the United States can continue being indebted to the degree that it is because it has the world's reserve currency, and it possesses that because of its military dominance.
It does, but I think what was a very important moment, however, was the seizing of the Russian reserves at the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
I felt that.
And I think we'll look.
Can you tell us what happened just for people?
Yeah, so quite simply, the Western powers seized the Russian reserves that were sitting in the New York Fed. I believe it's $300 billion is the number that they seized. And, the Europeans still want to use that for rebuild and so forth in Ukraine. Now, not to get into who's right and who's wrong in the Ukraine-Russia conflict. That's not the point of this. The point is it sets a precedent that's a scary precedent. That is, your money that sits in U.S. treasuries or gold in our Federal Reserve is not safe if you run afoul of the powers that be. So there's a very obvious and natural reaction function to that, which is powers like India, China, and Russia stop buying treasuries and start buying gold.
Understanding the implications of the U.S. debt particularly the staggering $37 trillion deficit, becomes crucial as the conversation shifts. The previous insights on inflationary pressures and fiscal strategies set the stage for exploring the trade-offs that shape economic ideologies. How do these factors influence decision-making in today's financial landscape?
So what's the right way to approach it?
Well, as I think, was it Thomas Sowell says, there are no solutions, only trade-offs.
Yeah.
There are no solutions when you're in this situation of $37 trillion deficit.
Is that a lot?
Sounds like a big number to me. I'm not even sure how many commas are in there. It's a big number. It's really hard to grasp. But I think you go back, you started with, you know, ideology. The answer is always going to depend to an extent on what your ideology is and what you're willing to sustain in terms of pain, short term to long term. And for me, I was more a proponent of what I thought the plan was going to be, which is some deficit cutting through spending cuts. And from what was coming out of DOGE early, it seemed like there was plenty of fat to cut that would have been politically rather popular, I think, especially with the right PR guys behind it. You know, guys were getting out there every week and on Twitter and going on podcasts and talking about sort of the absurdities they were finding. Now, maybe it's a drop in the bucket overall, but I think it was a worthwhile exercise to go with. I don't know. Again, I don't know. I'm not on the inside, so I don't see what
could
these
it be that
see.
There. I mean, so the idea always was that federal bureaucrats, public servants, as we call them, were serving, and they were making less than their private sector counterparts, and there was suffering involved, but patriotism impelled them to do it, so they did. And now you look at the numbers, and it's like, no. Your federal employee, on average, makes way more than your private sector.
2x.
Employee. 2x. So they're the most privileged people, okay, in the middle class, and by far.
That doesn't really count their gilded pension plan.
Is it really 2x?
I think the number is average medium private sector family income is 70K. I think it's 110 or 115 for federal.
Not including the benefits, which are ridiculous. Right. Work from home for 5 years. But then, you know, of course, the population of federal workers or federal contractors, which are, I mean, there are probably as many federal contractors. No one ever says that, but there are. Deloitte is a federal contractor, right? So there are so many of them now that we maybe have reached that tipping point where no administration can pivot against its own employees because they're voters.
Maybe, but you know, I'm sure you've alluded to it many times. Like, you can't have, what is it, 7 of the 10 top zip codes in the United States are all in sort of in and around Washington, D.C. I mean, I went to, you grew up there. I went to school there in the early 90s, and I hadn't been back for 15 years. It's night and day. It's a gleaming office towers, rows and rows. I remember having an internship 2 blocks from the White House, and you were passing, you had to pass sort of bombed out derelict buildings, and now it's just
from the 1968 riots. They never were rebuilt.
1992, yeah. They were still there, like literally 2 or 3 blocks from the White House.
Well, I remember.
And it's crazy. I mean, it's, again, flashes of Roman Empire, right? You go to Rome to collect your tribute. And I don't know. I'm not as privy to that world as you are. I don't know what people see when they get into office and realize that there's potentially no way, there's no way around it.
With concerns rising over the concentration risk in private credit markets and the massive borrowing tied to data centers, the conversation shifts to the potential implications for the economy at large. How will the fragile balance between tech's rapid growth and economic sustainability unfold? Tune in to explore this critical question.
Well, that's a bit of a concern about the value of the collateral, and when that daisy chain unwinds, it could be ugly. The other thing is that there's so much borrowing in the private credit markets for these hyperscalers and these data centers that it crowds out. There's a finite amount of borrowing available, right? So it's crowding out borrowing and investing in other areas of the economy. And that concentration risk concerns me to an extent as well. And a lot of people have made the analogy to, you know, the 99-2000 tech bubble. And you know, the good news coming out of that down the line is that, okay, we all got hyped up on the internet and we got carried away with pets.com, things like that.
E-toys.
But the truth was, in retrospect, we weren't hyped up enough about the internet and right. what it would do and how it would change the world. But there's still a cycle that comes along where there's the euphoric cycle and then the crash cycle. And then on the back end of that, you have the winners that survive, like the Amazons, right? That you could have bought for practically nothing in 2002. And then there are, you know, companies like, they're similar to me to this, the hyperscale data center were the fiber companies like Global Crossing, WorldCom, right? And those were bubbles that crashed. But what were they doing? They were laying fiber cable for the internet, which, okay, we had a malinvestment boom, the companies crashed, but cables still exist and the cables are in use today and the right. cables were very valuable and the cables didn't depreciate because the cables have a useful purpose. So the people are making the same argument now. It's like, okay, we may go through that cycle as well. It's maybe get a little euphoric. There'll be winners and losers out of this and it'll be fine down the road and AI is not going away. I'm not here to disagree with that. But there's a slightly different component where you're building these things that aren't, that could, you know, you're buying all these chips that could depreciate. It's not exactly the same trade.
No, and the nature of technology is hard to forecast, very hard to forecast.
Yeah.
I mean, so they were telling us 6 months ago that AGI was right around the corner. Nobody thinks that anymore. So for example, and so all of these infrastructure bets are predicated on predictions about what the technology will require in 10 years.
The thing that we're really running up against.
Do we know that?
We don't. You're exactly right. And I think there's the worm's turning a little bit on the efficiency of a lot of these.
Yes.
And what they can and can't do. And people say, you know, I saved a half an hour or I saved an hour coding something, but then it took me 3 hours to check, to debug the work that the actual, you know, Claude or whatever did. But the real thing that we're going to run into is we don't have enough power. We don't have enough electric and we don't have enough water to heat and cool all these things. That's just point blank. And even the, you know, Jensen and Altman and those guys, they'll tell you that. And that's why they're going hat in hand to DC and trying to make, trying to make the case that this is a critically important industry that may need some government backing. But even if you get that, the fact of the matter is the only way you can really power these things without spiking electricity bills another 300% and then creating a whole another political problem domestically is you need nuclear power. And, you know, we have plenty of natural gas that can work as a stopgap, but you need nuclear power and it's a 10-year build out minimum to get the nuclear power that you need. So when do we hit the, somewhere between there, here and that 10 years, we hit the wall in terms of our ability to get the electricity for these at this growth rate. Now, is this growth rate, accurate projection? Maybe it's not. And if it's not, then we need to see a lot of these companies come right. off in value. So
it, also, there are a lot of concerns about climate change.
Yes.
Oh, just kidding. That kind of ended quickly, didn't it?
Yeah.
I haven't heard that phrase in months. Have you?
Climate change. No, I did see. I saw something that Nature Magazine had to revoke a paper they did a few years ago that said that climate catastrophe was going to create a economic catastrophe, and that was all based on false premises. I think they did.
Yeah, I think the new idea is we're going to have an economic catastrophe if we think about the climate catastrophe in any way. I noticed Larry Fink's not lecturing as much about the climate anymore.
Climate and ESG is not as fashionable as it was a couple years ago, that's for sure.
So how did that...
Navigating the complexities of debt trading reveals how a balance of risk and instinct shapes market success. As our conversation shifts, the focus will pivot to understanding the traits of effective traders and how the financial landscape has evolved since the 2008 crisis. What challenges continue to influence trading today?
Different. It's a different mindset. The best traders I find were guys like to think with thought more in two dimensions. So if you thought in three dimensions, you could outsmart yourself way too much. The what ifs and but. And if you're in one dimension, you're just not at the IQ level to function. So the two dimension that kind of took the factors at play, saw what the trend was, took it at face value, didn't overthink it, went with it, and wasn't too much, had enough risk appetite, but wasn't too much of a cowboy, I guess, would be the perfect trader that I saw. The worst.
You're describing my dogs.
Yes. The worst traders I saw were oftentimes the smartest people.
Really?
Yeah.
Because they just overthink it.
You just overthink your way. You overtrade it. You overthink it. You're always looking at the... You're always looking at, oh, but this and that, and I have all this information. Your analysis paralysis and or talking yourself out of a good trade.
How did it change after the financial crisis?
We were egregiously overregulated. From all sides.
Did that make markets safer for retail investors?
I don't think so.
Because the picture you painted over the last hour and a half is not one of like impregnable safety.
No.
Let me just say that.
I mean, there's obviously a lot of unintended consequences from the excess regulation, but it just, you know, it's funny. On Wall Street, I think we were actually at the vanguard of hyper-regulation, hyper-monitoring. I mean, they were monitoring every Bloomberg chat, every email, every phone call. Everything was taped. Then they ran algos against it for keywords. You just like way more scrutiny in everything.
So you lived in the panopticon before everyone else.
Yeah, like, I did. And I think there's also, you know, a lot of... Going back to the global financial crisis is such a seminal moment in this country in a lot of ways, because it actually, we made this deal with the devil, and I'm a beneficiary of the bailout. I worked at a big bank that got bailed out, I'll never deny that. But in doing so, we let the Trojan horse in, and we married the government effectively, and they came in and they basically wrote our policies. They wrote our policies for us, and from HR policies to recruiting policies to all the regulation and the stuff that I saw from a distance in terms of sort of arbitrary fining for violations was kind of gangster-like, and I saw a lot of good people sort of thrown on the funeral pyre, sacrificed, just tossed out. Like, this guy was in violation. These guys weren't, but they were on the same Bloomberg chat. So let's give like 10 bodies. Everyone's fired. Everyone's career's over. That was a bad time. It's a bad time. And so everyone started trading scared. People tried trading scared, and it lost the joy, and it lost the...
But famously, none of the... You know, the CEO, the executive level seemed pretty insulated from punishment.
Yes. If I were going to give a more sort of generous take on it, you know, the CEOs really didn't have much of a choice in some regard. It was like, look, here's the deal. You could keep your job and keep making $25 million a year. Or if you agree to this fine for mortgage-backed securities or whatever, LIBOR rigging or whatever it is, this arbitrary number, you could keep your job and you can keep your salary, or you can get fired and the next guy will agree to it. Oh, like, and they kept it afloat. And they had to be in good stead with the government, or the fines and the regulation would just come and come and come and come.
That's all for today. Visit podsummarizer.xyz and start creating summaries of your own podcast in just seconds. Don't miss it.